Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio, of course, hosted by the wonderful Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Dealing with the Dead, A Life in the Morgue in Conversation with Cyril Wecht. And also, don't forget to get books by Jan Burke called Caught Red-Handed, and coming soon will be a new book called Original Sin by Doug Lyle. But now, everybody, here's your host of tonight's show, Doug Lyle.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it. We have a very special guest tonight, my dear friend, Dr. Cyril Wecht, who is your classic underachiever. Dr. Wecht has an MD degree that he received from the University of Pittsburgh, and as if that wasn't enough, a law degree from the University of Maryland. And he holds professorships at the University of Pittsburgh, and also at Duquesne University School of Law. He's published nearly 600 scientific articles and is on the editorial board of more than 20 medical, legal, and forensic scientific publications, and he's published several books on forensic science. And his list of famous cases that he's been involved in over his career, his brilliant and long career, is a who's who in medical legal investigation. Cyril, welcome to the show.
Doug, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here. Long time no see. What led you to a career in forensic pathology? How did you find yourself in this position?
I began to think about getting a degree in law and getting into legal medicine when I was finishing up my undergraduate days as a pre-med student. And once I made that decision, in somewhere in my third year of medical school, I began to think about a specialty in medicine that would be most frequently encountered, meaningful, relevant, and important at the interface of law and medicine. And clearly, it is forensic pathology, obviously. So I made that decision. And when I finished my internship and got accepted to law school, I also got accepted into a pathology residency. So I was able to do 2 years of pathology residency while I was at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law for 2 years. And unfortunately, before I could finish my third year of law school, the United States Air Force grabbed me. I had been deferred through college and med school, and I had to go in for 2 years. It was a wonderful 2 years, and in fact, I cut a real break because I got stationed at the largest Air Force hospital, Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. And I got credit for third and fourth years of pathology residency. When I came out, I needed just my fellowship in forensic pathology and the third year of law school, and I did those in Baltimore at the medical examiner's office where I was associate pathologist, research fellow in forensic pathology, and went to law school in the evening and getting my law degree then in 1962. So forensic pathology, which I have enjoyed, and I can't think of any other medical specialty that I would have preferred, really came about as a matter of my decision to go into legal medicine.
Wow. I mean, medical school was hard enough. Trying to do medical and law, I can't imagine. That had to be a grind.
Well, it's when you're young and you know what you want to do.
Right.
I was still living at home. I wasn't married. I didn't get married until I got out of the Air Force. And so, you know, as a single guy, I worked hard. I worked very hard. I'll give myself credit for that. But when I think, and when I think about what I did in those 5 years, which would have been required for pathology training, anatomic, clinical, and forensic pathology, in that same five-year period, I did 3 years of law school and 2 years of military service. So I was fortunate by working hard and willing to do so that I squeezed 10 into 5.
good job. I know. I look back now. There's no way physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, I could go back through medical school again now. Yeah, but when you're young and you don't know any better, it's like, okay, everybody around you is doing the same thing, so
yes.
you don't know how hard it is sometimes.
Right, right.
Well, you've been doing this a long time. How many autopsies have you performed in your career? What's your estimate?
Yes, my estimate is about 18,000, maybe going on toward 19,000 autopsies since I began to do autopsies in 1957 in my first year of pathology residency. In addition to those 19,000, I have supervised or reviewed about 38,000 other autopsies. Last year, for example, I did 409 autopsies. I've already done, my 81st one for this year. I did it just some hours ago, that's the way it goes. So I'm very busy with the autopsies and with the medical legal consultations. In the last three, four days, I had calls from four different attorneys on different cases. And I recently testified in a homicide trial in West Virginia, and then I had a deposition in another case of great significance. And these cases are all over. Police-related death in California, motor vehicular death with a truck rolling over them. You get into questions like conscious pain and suffering, et cetera. There's always something new and different, and it goes on. So it's stimulating. It's intellectually challenging. And it doesn't permit you to just sit back and take it easy.
Exactly. Well, you've established the Cyril Wecht Institute of Forensic Science and Law. Tell us a little bit about that, what it is, and what drove you to establish that, and what you actually do there at the Institute.
Yes. Actually, you're the dean of the Duquesne University School of Law in 2000, and a professor there who had been a friend of mine and still is a good friend but to this time both are, although the deanship has changed. I have been teaching at Duquesne Law School since 1962, I guess when I got out of the Air Force and came back to Pittsburgh. So they actually contacted me and asked me, since I was teaching and had been doing that in legal medicine and forensic science for those 38 years or so, what about establishing an institute of forensic science and law in your honor, Dr. Wecht, they said. So I said, well, thank you. I'd be delighted to do so. And that's how it came about. It's been a wonderful academic institution affiliated there at Duquesne. We have input from the different schools of toxicology, pharmacy, nursing, health sciences, law, of course, and what they call the general studies program. We have a marvelous bunch of people. We have national conferences, one or two a year, and then we have different programs during the year. And we work closely with the five-year master's degree program at Duquesne University. It's a very special program. I don't know if there are any others like it around the country. There may be. These are college entry-level students who sign up for 5 years and then they get a master's degree, not just a Bachelor of Science, but a master's degree. So while that's a different entity, we're closely related. Our national conferences have been outstanding, and we have dealt with subjects always on the spot, subjects that are really hot. I remember many years ago starting off with DNA, we had Barry Scheck come in, and we dealt with some of the so-called child sexual abuse cases, which were hot items, with the cases in Massachusetts and New Jersey, which people still write and talk about, and medical malpractice, of course. And then we did in 2003, the 40th anniversary of JFK, and just last fall, the 50th anniversary program. Back in 2008, we did the 45th anniversaries. Well, it would have been the 40th anniversaries of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations a few years ago. We had the marvelous program on football head injuries, cerebral concussions, which was coming to be a big thing. Our national conference this fall is going to be on cold cases. I recently became a member of a board dealing with cold cases, and a marvelous group of people. I'm sure you know many of them. We were just mentioning our dear mutual friend, Dr. Catherine Ramsland, Mark Safarik, who have been a former FBI profiler, Dr. Henry Lee, of course, who's my dear friend and close colleague. So that's the kind of thing we do at our Institute of Forensic Science and Law at Duquesne University.
Yeah, I remember the one we did many years ago that we kind of brought Hollywood into that world.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And that was
right,
that was had so much fun doing that, working with you and your son, Ben. And just so people know, one of the little things we did with that thing that to me was just wonderful. We had Ann Rule scheduled to come there and talk, but she couldn't make it. And I remember you guys used your technology and set up a video conference, and she was on the big screen there in that room and answered questions.
Right.
And that was so special. To this day, I remember that so well. And I saw Ann a year ago at a conference, and she is still thrilled about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, by the way, my latest book, Final Exams,
right,
is published by Ann Rule. It's planetannrule.com, Final Exams. It's came out as an ebook, and about 3-4 weeks it'll be in published form. Got some wonderful, wonderful cases, two of which were around here involving fascinating murders, and then two others, both of which are cases that have been on national television. You know, that case in New York where a guy is charged with murder. He was hustled by a wealthy white guy, this African-American fellow walking there in Harlem, called over to a car, and the guy said he wanted to pay him to help him kill himself. He had taken $13 million worth of insurance. He was in bad shape financially. And anyway, so that's one of the cases. These are all cases, of course, in which I have testified and been involved, as are all the other cases that are written about in my different books over the years. But I wanted to mention that one when you mentioned Ann Rule. She's a wonderful person, and I'm delighted to be associated with her and to have her as the publisher of my latest book.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I love Ann. She's such a sweetheart. Well, as you well know, and our writer friends out there know because I've been yelling at them about it for years, is that in the medical legal system, you have the coroner and you have the medical examiner system, and you are obviously incredibly well-credentialed, and most big major cities have well-credentialed forensic pathologists. But out in the real world and the smaller communities, that's not always the case. Anybody with a pulse can almost be the coroner. How important is it, if we're moving toward trying to standardize science and make it more standard and more universal so that everybody gets the same break regardless of what courtroom and what jurisdiction you're in, how important is credentialing to
coroner,
medical examiner, forensic pathologist?
Very important, and I would like to call your listeners' attention to the National Academy of Sciences report, which came out around February 18th of 2009, and they make a very, very strong appeal for national credentialing, accreditation, the need to upgrade forensic science laboratories, and so on. And they cover a lot of other things, as you know, pointing out some of the inadequacies that exist in forensic science for different reasons, and also pointing out some of the things that some of my colleagues have claim to be kind of, you know, absolute fixed sciences, which are not so, including, by the way, fingerprints, let alone bite marks and the hair analysis, etc. On the subject of coroners and medical examiners, you have to be a little bit more careful about that in lumping everything together. It's really a matter of how the person running the office understands, comprehends, and approaches his, her job. It's not really the title. You are right that in many rural communities, people get elected coroner, and it's not just because they themselves are not forensic pathologists, but because many of them don't think at all about what's going on, and they don't pursue the job in the proper fashion. If you have, however, a coroner who is a good administrator and who knows what the forensic science medical legal investigation system is all about, then he or she, you see, can employ and utilize forensic pathologists, toxicologists, and when necessary, call upon an anthropologist here, an entomologist there, an odontologist, and toxicologist, of course, and so on. As a matter of fact, you know, what's interesting, and I never set out with this objective in mind, when I began to write my books, Cause of Death, Grave Secrets, Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey, Mortal Evidence, Tales from the Morgue, Question of Murder, and Final Exams. And so I never started off with the idea in mind that I was going to deal with coroner and medical examiner questions in that ongoing debate. But when I think of it, and I have many times, people get into it about the cases that have been some of the biggest debacles, some of the cases that have been messed up terribly, some of the cases where things haven't been done right, where they've been covered up. It's interesting. It's almost an incredible irony, a paradox, that most of those have occurred in medical examiner jurisdictions, not in a local coroner. John F. Kennedy, well, it wasn't the fault of the medical examiner in Dallas, but it was, so to speak, in an ME system setup that resulted in the autopsy being done by two pathologists at Bethesda Naval Hospital who had never done a gunshot wound autopsy in their entire careers. Robert F. Kennedy, the decision not, Robert F. Kennedy, the way in which it was handled in the courtroom, which wasn't the fault of Dr. Tom Noguchi, my dear friend who did the autopsy and who did an outstanding, absolutely fantastic medical legal autopsy, was never given the opportunity to explain everything. A cross-examination never occurred to have permitted him to talk about the gunshot wounds and so on. And so this is an ME system, although it wasn't, as I say, Dr. Noguchi's fault, but that occurred within that context. And then the triad of the Kennedy cases, Mary Jo Kopechne involving Ted Kennedy, there at Chappaquiddick, Pocopon, on the shore stood a guy, a medical doctor with a fancy title of deputy medical examiner in the first state in America to adopt a medical examiner system in 1877, 92 years later, 1969, who makes a decision that it was not necessary to do an autopsy on the body of a young woman found submerged in a car. And we can go on. Elvis Presley.
We are going to go on. We're going to talk about some of those.
I'm just mentioning cases that have been screwed up royally.
Sure.
O.J. Simpson and a lot of other cases. I'm just saying that they have occurred in medical examiner jurisdictions for different reasons. Vincent Foster, Ron Brown. When you get the government involved, you see. I'll tell you one thing about the coroner system. If you have a coroner that has the interest, the intellectual, acuity, and who has the desire to do what is necessary, that person, especially in jurisdictions like we used to have in Allegheny County when I was a coroner, the traditional inquisitorial powers of the English coroner system to conduct open inquest and get into things, you see, that really is ideal. Under the medical examiner system, just think about this. MEs in this country, and the best, the brightest, and so on, their offices almost exclusively do not do a single thing beyond the autopsy. What I mean by that is, it's up to the district attorney to determine whether they'll file charges, cases that involve police-related deaths and so on. They're never brought to the attention of the public. They're never pursued because district attorneys aren't going to go after their fellow cops and so on. I'm just saying that the coroner versus medical examiner question, which maybe we can talk about another time for a whole hour, is not quite as clear-cut and as simplistic as I indeed myself used to think,
yeah.
And as many people still do think. So it's a matter of who runs the system and how it is done, not what the title of the office may be.
Right. Well, along that line, I mean, I know there's a shortage of qualified forensic pathologists in the country. Do you think a program such as scholarship, a program for to entice medical students to get into this and to move in that direction in exchange for a certain period of time to serve the public as a forensic pathologist, do you think something like that might help?
That's a very good idea. Thank you for thinking of it and tossing it out there. Sure, I think that the government could get involved in this because, you know, forensic pathologists don't make in terms of their salaries from the cities, counties, or states, the kind of money that they could make as a hospital pathologist.
Sure.
And so, therefore, that's one of the main reasons that not many people go into forensic pathology. Of course, a lot of people aren't interested in that kind of work. I can't handle it emotionally, psychologically. I don't
sure.
mean they can't handle it intellectually. So something that might be governmentally sponsored would be a good idea. And hearkening back to the National Academy of Sciences report, they called for funding and help from the federal government, which is yet to happen. A few weeks ago, they established a National Commission on Forensic Science. We'll see if that does anything, and we'll see if any money is forthcoming. But your idea, which is somewhat analogous to people getting paid getting their medical school tuition paid and then pay back time either
right.
to the military or working on a Native American reservation or in a public health facility or so on. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, I thought so. Well, most people believe that a medical examiner deals only with dead folks and, you know, murders and suicides and where there's a body involved. But that's really not always the case. What does the coroner medical examiner's office bring to the living? Kind of cases do you get involved there?
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful question, and you see, it's a marvelous sequel to what I was talking about a moment ago. My major criticism of most medical examiner's offices is that they don't follow through and they allow other people, if it's on the criminal side, the district attorney, if it's the political side, governmental side, the mayor or the county commissioner or executive or so on, and they don't follow through because either they don't have that power written into the legislation that created them or because they don't understand what the office is all about. I thank you very much for mentioning this because, to me, this has been the biggest single point I try to make in teaching and lecturing about forensic pathology or just discussing it with public audiences, which I've done thousands of times and will continue to do. And that is that medical legal investigation, forensic pathology, involves a lot more than just death investigation. First of all, we deal with a lot of kinds of cases that in my consultations for attorneys all over the country, that do not involve death. It might be infant child, spousal, elderly abuse. It might be product liability cases. I can tell you some fascinating cases involving product liability that get into this rape and sexual assault, medical malpractice, wrongful injury, and may or may not lead to death, but a lot of the cases don't result in death. I do a lot of cases, retired coal miners, black lung, pneumoconiosis cases. I do a lot of asbestosis, mesothelioma cases, and all. You know, a lot of these people are not dead. So they may be dead, they may not be dead, but these are areas of litigation, both in the civil and criminal fields. I've been involved in cases that get into questions of child custody because you've got to see about certain injuries or so on. And that whole area of child injury, is it head injury, trauma, gotten away from calling these things battered the shaken baby syndrome, and they've come to learn that it's not quite as simple as it was first postulated. But the point to be made is just what you said. It involves a lot of living people.
Well, that's a great answer, and it's absolutely true, and most people don't understand that the forensic pathologists also deal with the living. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some specific cases and have some more fun with Dr. Cyril Wecht.
So welcome, everybody, again after the break here to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Again, today's show is called Dealing with the Dead, A Life in the Morgue in Conversation with Cyril Wecht. So now again, everybody, here's your host of today's show, Doug Lyle.
Well, welcome. I want to welcome everybody back. We're having a great conversation with my friend, Dr. Cyril Wecht, and we've kind of covered a lot about coroners and medical examiners. Let's talk about autopsy for a minute. Everybody thinks that the medical examiner, the forensic pathologist, can walk into the lab and work magic in the CSI way and come away with the answer all the time. But that's not always the case. What are the most difficult causes and manners of death to determine at autopsy? And what's the most unusual or odd manner of death and things like that that you've run across in your career?
Well, obviously, if you have a body which is in some way significantly altered, then a lot of things will be destroyed, significantly altered, and maybe even markedly obfuscated. You may not be able to identify bruises, even lacerations, let alone abrasions and contusions. You could even miss bullet wounds and stab wounds and so on. So a body that has been subjected to postmortem decomposition, and that it can go all the way from just some discoloration and bloating to the point of eventual skeletonization. You know, what can you determine if you only have skeletal remains? Even somebody who was shot, if the bullet did not hit a bone, you're not going to be able to determine that. A body found in water, that's a difficult case. Drowning is a diagnosis which is an exclusionary one. You have to rule out everything else, and that's a difficult situation, especially to determine many times whether it's accidental, suicidal, or homicidal. Cases of a fire victim, you get someone who is severely burned or charred and so on. Once again, you can just picture most people haven't seen a severely burned body where soft tissues are destroyed to the point even that you can look into a chest or abdominal cavity and so on. So there's going to be a lot of things that are obscured. Those are difficult cases. With regard to manner of death and cause of death, let me just very quickly point out the difference. Cause of death, a gunshot wound to the head, for example. The manner of death could be homicide, accident, or suicide. A person who dies in a hospital or at home where the death certificate is signed out by a private physician or a hospital physician, there's no block for manner of death. Coroner and medical examiner death certificates, you have five choices in order of decreasing frequency of occurrence: natural, accident, suicide, homicide, or undetermined. Sometimes you just cannot be sure. What are the difficult cases on manner of death? Well, let's say two people are in a little shoving match or something following a car accident, and shortly thereafter, the guy drops dead and he's got a heart attack. You may be quite comfortable with signing out the cause of death as a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, a severe atherosclerosis of the coronary arteries and so on. But is it a homicide because the other guy punched him, pushed him, shoved him, and so on? Or is it a natural death? How's about these cases involving the police that I referred to before, police-related deaths? Are they homicides? Are they accidents? What there were a case of somebody who has drugs, and as you know, we're experiencing a tremendous epidemic, although drug deaths have always been around. But drug deaths, you'll determine the cause of death if you do a good autopsy, rule out everything, and you get the toxicological analysis back from a competent forensic toxicologist. There'll be no question. Let's say that the death is due to a combination of 3, 4, 5 drugs or whatever. But what about the manner of death? Was it accidental, or was it suicide, or is it possible that it might have been homicide? So those are very difficult cases. There's a lot of situations where you just can't be really sure on the manner of death. You got to be careful and not jump to conclusions or not simply buy into what the cop may tell you or the homicide detective when he comes in and they're expressing their opinions possibly with some degree of bias, whether it's conscious or unconscious. Cause of death is not so much a problem for a competent forensic pathologist. It is very, very infrequent, I'm tempted to say rare, that a thorough, complete autopsy will not reveal a cause of death. I'd say maybe less than 1%, something like that. But manner of death, because here you get into differences of opinion. You get into subjective interpretation by equally competent, experienced forensic pathologists. How does it happen that you've got these murder cases, just think, as well as medical malpractice and product liability and wrongful death and so on, occurring every day somewhere in America. You and I don't know about them except for the cases that make the news one way or another, but there are cases every day in America, guaranteed, someplace there are doctors giving opinions that are diametrically opposed, and both are board-certified specialists. In the field of forensic pathology, I'm sure there's not a week that goes by, I'm tempted to say maybe not a day, but let's just comfortably say a week doesn't go by that there's not a murder case or a death case of a civil nature occurring somewhere in the United States of America in which competent forensic pathologists are giving totally, totally contrasting opinions regarding the manner of death.
Yep.
So there's the difference between the two, and it's important to point out not to confuse cause of death, manner of death, or even mechanism of death. And so, but the cases that I referred to are the difficult ones in trying to figure out sometimes with a badly decomposed, burned body, a body that has been extensively damaged in an explosion or in a major motor vehicle accident or a collapse of a building or something like that where the fractures and the soft tissue injuries are so extensive that it's almost impossible to reconstruct things and to try to find out what did they die from. And by the way, in that regard, a question that I experience quite often as a medical legal consultant on the private side of my practice, differentiated from the autopsies I do for coroners in various counties, a question that comes up often is conscious pain and suffering. And here the forensic pathologist plays a major role. I've been involved in some fantastic cases, and a lot of people don't realize conscious pain and suffering in court, the civil damages, you know, can be the difference between a hamburger from McDonald's or a lobster steak dinner at the best restaurant in town, in terms, you know, analogously, metaphorically speaking, in terms of money. I mean, if let's say identical twins with identical injuries and death occurring, you know, pretty much at the same time or presumably at the same time, if you can show everything is exactly the same, but if you can show that twin A survived even a matter of a couple of seconds after the injuries were sustained, then that estate will get multiple times the amount of money that the estate of twin B, who was identical in every way, got because twin B died immediately and did not experience any conscious pain and suffering. So these are fascinating things that we encounter and deal with in forensic pathology.
The devil's in the details. Well, I mentioned in the intro that you've had interfaced with many famous cases. And let's talk about a couple of them because I think the listeners would really be interested. So let's start with John F. Kennedy. One shooter or two? What does the data show? What do you think?
Well, two shooters, there's no question. The single bullet theory, which is the sine qua non of the Warren Commission Report's conclusion about a sole assassin, is totally absurd. This is my favorite presentation, and we've demonstrated this repeatedly. This is a bullet which is allegedly responsible for seven wounds in two men that moved in horizontal and vertical directions that would make the best roller coaster ride at an amusement park here. It looked like a child's play. And that's the single bullet theory. Without that, you don't have you can't have just one shooter. There were two shooters, one from the rear and one from behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. The ballistics evidence, the forensic pathology, the radiographic evidence, the photographic evidence, this has been done and repeated, as well as, by the way, the testimony from people who were there. You'll recall a program that we did, and you were there, Doug, and we have somebody on video, Ann Rule, right? So we just did that with our Kennedy 50th anniversary program last fall at our Duquesne University Institute of Forensic Science and Law. We had Dr. Robert McClellan, one of the chief surgeons, who was there in Parkland Hospital on that fateful day of Friday, November 22nd, 1963. He was standing for about a half an hour right on the side of Kennedy's head, holding the retractor while they were dealing with the neck wound and so on. And he spoke, this marvelous man, for an hour, live television. And he said there was no question that that was a shot that had come from the front. So all of that evidence is no question. And by the way, every national poll, 70 to 85% of the American public has rejected the Warren Commission report. And it's been out there despite all of the efforts, including some things that haven't been exactly ethical, believe me, on the part of the federal government and the self-appointed proponents and sycophants and defenders and of the Warren Commission report. Despite all of those efforts, and despite books by people who have tried to reinforce, reinvigorate, reincarnate the Warren Commission report, they have failed. They have failed to sell it to the American public. So that's the story on JFK.
Great answer. I agree. Well, speaking of political death, Vince Foster. And in case people don't remember, Vince Foster was found dead in a car in Washington, D.C. in a park, and the park police, I think, first found him. And I think it was officially determined to be a suicide, but there's been tremendous controversy about whether it's a suicide or a murder. What's the story with Vince Foster?
Yeah, I was a consultant in that case.
Right.
He was found, by the way, he wasn't in his car, he was in the park, you're right, Fort Marcy Park, just over the border in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. He was very close personally to both Bill and Hillary Clinton, and in fact, his office was right there in the White House, and there he was found. By the way, they never recovered the bullet in that case. Can you believe that? Here's an example. The case was done by a medical examiner in Virginia, and yet got all screwed up. Well, the X-ray machine didn't work. This didn't pan out exactly. Here's an example of what I'm talking about, because the government got involved and so on. And you're quite right. There was a lot of controversy, and still remains today. Was it a suicide? I concluded that it most probably was, but I definitely could not rule out that it was a staged event because of the lousy investigation done. The homicide investigation, incredibly, was handled by the Park Police. The FBI and the Washington, D.C. and Virginia homicide detectives were too busy, so they got the Park Police to stop worrying about who was making out in the back seat of a car or who was throwing garbage out the window, and they said, you guys handle this homicide and this death investigation. That's an example of what I'm talking about in a medical examiner jurisdiction. Yes, a very good case.
Well, the so-called, one of the many crimes of the century, of course, was O.J. Simpson. And
yes, right.
The controversy there, of course, is, you know, did he act alone? Was someone with him? Was it even him? You know, that kind of thing. I don't think there's much doubt he was involved, but do you think he did it alone? Was there someone with him? What does the evidence suggest?
I'll tell you what I believe, and although I don't speak for other people,
right,
but I can in this case I'm able to because we've discussed this many times. I was a consultant in that case, although I did not testify because I got too much involved with the news media at that time. But both Dr. Henry Lee and Dr. Michael Bodden and I separately, independently, came to the same conclusion. O.J. Simpson, I agree with your statement, was involved, but there was a second person. When you think of the fact that one of the victims had about 18 stab wounds, and the other about 21, 22 stab wounds. When you think about the blood that would have spurted all over the place, and then you think about, where is the blood? Where did it all go? Where's the clothing? Where's the weapon? One drop of blood on one sock found at his residence, and so on. This is an example. You see, now it wasn't it was the medical examiner's fault in a way, because they allowed the homicide detectives to handle this case. They weren't given access to the body until about 10:30 in the morning. It was about 10, 11 hours after these deaths presumably occurred that the ME ever laid hands on the body. And you see, that, of course, destroyed the most important feature in this case. When did these deaths occur? Because there was a very short period of time in which O.J. could have committed this. So that then, coupled, of course, with what unfolded in the trial, they destroyed the DNA evidence. Barry Schick did a masterful job on that. F. Lee Bailey did the best cross-examination that has ever, to my knowledge, occurred in a courtroom with Mark Furman leading up to it, when he said, you know, and so, Detective Furman, are you telling Judge Ito and the ladies and gentlemen of the jury that you never used the N-word? And there sat a jury with 9 African-Americans, knowing damn well that he had lied. You see what I mean? So that, a beautiful statement about the O.J. case. Henry Lee, my dear friend Henry, says, and 90% African-American people believe O.J. innocent. 90% white people think O.J. guilty. 90% Chinese people don't give a shit. But the O.J. case was bungled. It was bungled. And it was bungled by any medical examiner jurisdiction. I firmly, strongly believe that there was a second person involved there with O.J.
I think that's a good probability. Another case that's always fascinated me, and it looks like it's going to be reopened again, at least Jeff McDonald's trying to. This, of course, is the Greenbury doctor who killed his wife and 2 children in North Carolina. Right. And, you know, said hippies came in and did it and yada, yada, yada. Was he guilty, or did the evidence suggest strongly that he was guilty, or was he the victim of a botched investigation or somewhere in between?
Yeah. Well, it was a botched investigation. There's no question about it. They messed up some of the blood spatter evidence at the scene and so on. I was involved in that case and was a consultant with the attorney and worked on that case a great deal. The answer to your question is, in my opinion, that there was not enough evidence upon which to find him guilty of murder. As you and I know, you know, the jury really has to be able to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the evidence clearly points to it. In the military trial, he was acquitted, and then because the stepfather of the deceased wife became angry when Jeffrey moved away and then began to date women and so on, he felt that Jeffrey had betrayed trust and so on, and went after him with a vengeance, and that resulted then in the trial. I had correspondence for many years. I haven't had recently with Jeffrey McDonald, and as you said, he's been trying now for some time to get a new trial. I would hope you're right that it's going to happen, but I'm not aware of that occurring, and thus far it has not come to fruition.
Right. I know he's been fighting for it for a long time. Actually, one of my partners was in training at St. Mary's Hospital up in the Long Beach area where Jeff was the ER doc there, and so he knew him at that time.
Yeah.
Well, another case that's captured the public's attention for far too long and is unresolved is JonBenet Ramsey. And the theories, of course, parents or the brother or an intruder or somebody did something horrible to this young girl. What does the evidence suggest in that case? What's your opinion on that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a book, Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey?
Right.
And it lays it all out. In my opinion, who was responsible? Not intentionally. There was no desire at all of harming the little girl, let alone killing her. But I do believe it was the father, and I believe it occurred during a perverted sex game that had been played before. This little six-year-old girl, a good part of the hymen was absent. There was evidence of chronic inflammation inside the vaginal vault, indicating that there had been inflammation, irritation for some time before. There was focal superficial erosion at the 7 o'clock position within the vagina on the mucosal surface, and there was a birefringent material seen under polarized light, the most ubiquitous source of that in any household being talcum powder. If you put it all together, in my opinion, it demonstrates that this was a game that had been played before. There was no intruder. My God, somebody coming into the house and not awakening anybody, knowing where the little girl's bedroom was, knowing about a back step, a set of stairs in the back of the house that led into the basement to a room that nobody even, the homicide detectives arriving there at 6 o'clock in the morning never even found the room, never even saw the room. A maid who had worked there for a year never even knew it existed for 6 months. But this outside intruder, he knew it. He knew where that room was. And then he has his way with the little girl. And after he kills her, he says, you know, I'm going to make this a profitable one as well as an enjoyable one. I'm going to stage a kidnapping. He finds pen and paper in the middle of the night, total darkness. He writes a ransom note. We represent a small foreign faction. They demanded $118,000. That's a nice round number, right?
Yeah.
And he leaves the note, and then he leaves the house. What did he forget? This cunning, manipulative, daring guy who knows all of these things and so on. What does he do? He forgets to take JonBenet Ramsey's 45-pound body with him. He leaves the body along with the ransom note, huh? Do you like that? That's the intruder theory. Yeah, that's the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Well, as our listeners know, we always put links up on the various sites. My site, my website, John puts it on his, and Jan has it on our crimeandscienceradio.com site. And we will have links to your books and bio and institute and all that stuff. But you have two wonderful books that I think everyone should read, Grave Secrets and Silent Witness. Both of them are wonderful, wonderful books. Tell us about those and kind of give us a thumbnail of what they
are.
Well,
in all of my books, A Cause of Death and Grave Secrets, all of the books, I've dealt with cases that I have been involved in directly and personally. And, you know, they cover the cases we've talked about, as well as Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson and Anna Nicole Simpson and Phil Spector and Chandra Levy a bunch of others. Sonny Von Bulow and so on. So these books, I guess, are all available. However, people get books, Amazon or whatever. Yeah. And the nice thing in the last few books, which I've worked with Donna Kaufman, my co-author, including Final Exam, the thing that I think makes these books worthwhile and meaningful, interesting, and intellectually fascinating is that we give information that people just aren't aware of and could not have known, did not know, or so on. For example, when I talk about the death at Memorial Hospital in Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, I set forth all of the toxicological analysis showing that these people were deliberately euthanized. Dr. Poe went around and gave these massive doses of analgesics and so on, et cetera. This was never published. Nobody was ever brought to trial. So the people who are interested in real-life stories, and you know the famous aphorism, whoever was it that said it for the first time, the truth is stranger than fiction.
Yes.
It's no more valid than one finds in the realm of death investigation in the field of forensic pathology. True, real cases, if you have some of these fascinating cases, are more exciting, more interesting, more intellectually challenging and stimulating than the stuff on TV, because they get too dramatic and
exactly.
You begin to sometimes find them a little absurd, a little silly, a little too far stretched. But if you see something that is real and you read it and you know that this actually occurred, that really is something that is worthwhile. So I thank you for mentioning those books.
Yep.
And as I mentioned, final exams will be out in a few weeks, published by Ann Rule, some interesting cases. And we'll have a couple more books, I hope, by the end of the year.
Good. One final question. And you mentioned it earlier that not everybody's cut out for your profession. How do you weather through all of this? Because this is down and dirty medicine. I mean, this is tough stuff.
Sure.
And how has it impacted you, and how do you handle it?
Yeah, well, it is. I think it's made me much more aware of the poignancy of life, the vicissitudes, the unpredictability, the tragedies, the human frailties, and so on. I think it's made me a more sensitive person. I try very hard in every autopsy I do to think of that person, that individual, the person that may have killed him or her, responsible for the death, that individual's family, or so on, even person who dies in prison, what was he like, how long had he been in prison, what did he think, what did he do, and so on. So if you relate those to everyday life and you think about people, then it's it's like constantly reading a book of different human sagas. I think it's to say it's changed my life. I don't want to be too dramatic myself, but it certainly has impacted my life and made me think a lot more about people as individual human beings and all the strengths and weaknesses of people, as well as society, of course. That's what kind of career does to you.
Yeah, I think medicine and all of its permutations and combinations does that to all the practitioners. It's part of our life, I guess.
Yes, it is,
well,
Doug.
I want to thank you so, so much for being here. This has been a personal pleasure, and I know our listeners are going to absolutely love everything you've had to say.
Well, my pleasure.
As I said, there will be links on the site for further reading. There's some video links for interviews that Dr. Wecht has given on several of these cases. And there's links to his books. And go buy them and read them. You are in for a treat. Cyril,
thanks,
always
sir.
A pleasure,
my
friend.
Thank you very much for having me as a guest. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.